Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day. Kathy Day is the author of The Circus in Winter, a finalist for the Story Prize, the Great Lakes Book Award, and the GLCA New Writers Award. Her fiction and nonfiction have appeared in New Stories from the South, Antioch Review, Southern Review, Shenandoah, and SI.com. She teaches in the writing program at the University of Pittsburgh. Hi, Kathy. Thanks for coming to Prosody.
It's wonderful to be here again.
And you'll be reading tonight from your memoir, Comeback Season, which was published by Free Press.
Okay. You need to know this. In the game of love, my team has always lost in spectacular fashion. As with the Colts, some seasons begin with great promise, but something goes awry in the playoffs. Afterwards, I sit on the bench with my head in my hands and my heart in my stomach. I walk to the locker room where a teammate gives me that post-game pep talk. There is a Super Bowl ring in your future. I just know it, Kathy. Now you're a free agent, and some team is going to snatch you up. I know I must believe this. I know there's always next year. As Tim Robbins says in Bull Durham, it's a very simple game once you learn your interview cliches. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, and sometimes it rains. A reporter sticks a microphone in my face. Kathy, what went wrong? Well, I'm disappointed. I put myself in good position, no question. But he had home field advantage. He just wasn't able to take that next step, and that's disappointing. It's hard to swallow. Kathy, you're coming off a tough loss. You're 37 years old. You've never been married. This season began with such high hopes. Everyone, especially your mother, really thought this was the year. How do you feel right now? Are you kidding me? How do I feel? Yes. How does a player pick up the pieces year after year, come back, and try again? Well, I used to know the answer to that question. It was, you just do. But honestly, I don't know if I have it in me to go through this again. Are you planning to retire? They say you still have a few good years left to play. Look, right now, I just want to get drunk and sleep for 2 days, okay? Okay. This is Susie Hightop, reporting live. Back to you, Bob.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day, reading from her memoir, Comeback Season. You know, Kathy, I'm glad you started with that section because I was thinking about the fact that your first book was a work of fiction, and now this is a memoir, and the analogy of the locker room interview. Every time I see a reporter interview somebody in the locker room, they always ask them the same kind of questions. How do you feel about the loss, or how do you feel about the win? And we get these very canned answers. And at times I even wonder, like, why do they even do that anymore?
I know.
Because you just get the same answer and you're like, yeah, whatever, let's get back to the game or back to whatever. But in putting those questions up and in partnering, you know, the memoir has a background of your long devotion to sports and your family's affinity for sports. And then also this very personal memoir essay about feeling lost in lots of ways. And so you really have to answer those questions.
Right.
Did you ever find yourself like just trying to back off of them, or were they really a device that helped you get into them more?
Well, the device of the interviewer, the Susie Hightop, she became she became sort of my friend as I wrote this. And I thought of her as she, you know, she was a way for me to ask myself really important questions, but also she sort of at times I imagined her as Susie Colbert, you know, a real interviewer. And sometimes she was a staunch feminist asking me really hard questions like, well, what, why do you need to get married? What's so important about that? Why is love so important? And sometimes she was my worst enemy, you know, saying, you know, well, you know, you failed, you know, or she would sometimes she'd be my friend and say, you're being really hard on yourself. So, you know, it was a device, a fictional device that I needed to sort of tell the truth about myself. And I'm really interested as a fiction writer in in the that sort of murky middle between fiction and nonfiction, how we need both in order to tell a story.
Right. And I was thinking in terms, you know, I think most fiction writers use their characters as a way of putting a facade between themselves and the material that they're working with. You know, it's easy to say, well, that's not me. That's one of my characters.
Right.
Were you missing that when you were writing this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I think the only reason, you know, I've been asked a lot, like, well, why didn't you just turn this into a novel? And instead of Kathy, call her Carol. And for me, the important thing was that I wanted other women and men who are in my situation. I dedicated this book to, it's dedicated to all the lonely people. And I knew that I wasn't alone because I would talk to people about struggling to find someone to love after at a certain point of life. It's not that easy to find people anymore. Mm-hmm. And I knew that it mattered that I wanted people to know that it was me speaking and talking about my own experiences, because I do think that there are times when it matters that it's not fiction, to know that something really happened to somebody. And that's what, you know, that's why I decided to make it nonfiction.
That's great. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day, reading from her memoir, Comeback Season. Kathy, will you read a bit more for us?
Sure. This is a part about shortly after I moved to Pittsburgh. I realized that I was missing home. So this is I think that football is one of those things that helps us connect to where we're from. I'm at a Colts preseason game. By the time the Colts take the field, the RCA Dome is almost at full capacity, and the crowd goes crazy to welcome them. This is the first time that they've run onto this field since they lost to the Steelers here in January. This is, of course, when the Steelers went to the Super Bowl. And everyone seems to want to buoy the Colts with their support. Then it hits me. Everyone around me is wearing blue and white. Everyone around me is a Hoosier. Everyone around me loves the Colts. I have spent most of my adult life living in self-imposed exile, an Indiana expatriate, but at this moment, I am home. I feel connected, albeit tenuously, to tens of thousands of people, all occupying the same space. We're wearing the same thing, singing the same song, screaming the same cheers. I belong to something. I am not alone. It's not a family, it's a tribe, and I never realized until now how much I needed this. Sometimes, during the last year in Pittsburgh, I've seen a car go by with an Indiana license plate, or I've seen someone wearing a Purdue University sweatshirt, and I've had to resist the urge to walk right up to them and say, "Hi, are you from Indiana? Me too." How is this possible? All I wanted at 17 was to escape Indiana by any means necessary, and 20 years later, I'm in a very large room with 50,000 Hoosiers, and I don't ever, ever want to leave.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day, reading from her memoir, Comeback Season. One of the things I noticed in that the book deals with in a very serious, but also in a way that keeps the reader engaged, because it's humorous, mm-hmm. so it's that tension between the two, has to do with issues of gender mm-hmm. and expectations, both from you of yourself as a woman, mm-hmm. but also other people from what's going to get you a date. Mm-hmm. And a number of people throughout the book give you advice about what's going to work. I'm curious, what was the advice that surprised you the most?
The advice that surprised me the most? The advice that surprised me the most was when women I knew as feminists said to me, "You need to just accept that that your dreams in terms of love and marriage cannot be attained. You need to accept that you need to act dumb in order to make a man feel comfortable enough with you to want to see you again." I was really surprised at the level that so many women themselves. It was the advice that women themselves gave me that surprised me. It didn't surprise me when my brother said, "Well, you better not use any big words when you talk to your dates or they're going to feel stupid." You know, I wasn't surprised that my brother said that. But it surprised me that women that represented sort of what I was aspiring to as a woman, as a feminist, as a professional, were basically saying to me, like, just kind of shaking their heads. And it was hard to decide how to weigh that in terms of, you know, what the decisions that I was having to make about whether to pursue relationships with men that I met when I was doing all this dating, I've had women say to me, I really thought you should have stuck it out with so-and-so. And I'm like, why would you think that? I didn't like him at all. And they're like, well, so?
Yeah, there's a couple times in the sections that I was reading that I thought when women were saying it's better to be with someone than to be alone, even if you don't like the person that much. Mm-hmm. And I thought, ouch, haven't we come further than that by now?
I think that in many ways, this topic of dating, marriage, and stuff, it cuts so close to the bone about who we are as people and what we're willing, sort of our outlook on life, mm-hmm. our needs, our sort of human needs for intimacy, whether or not we're somebody that really needs to have a strong and positive relationship in their life, or whether you're somebody that really just actually sees marriage as some kind of contract. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you really learn when people give you advice about marriage, it really reveals a lot about their own attitudes towards that.
Now, did you find you were getting a different response from male readers than you were from female readers to the conversations? Because it seems with the women, at least as they're presented in the book, the conversations you had, there's still some kind of awkwardness about femininity and professionalism. And I don't know if it's true that men just don't think about things in that way, or I'm not sure if they think about their femininity mm-hmm. all that often. But, you know, the idea of who am I in my most vulnerable way? Who am I in my most assertive way? Did you find any kind of difference in response?
No, actually, I found that a lot of men who read the book said that they identified with my problems in terms of, you know, feeling like I want to meet people, but I don't want to go to bars. I don't want to feeling sort of trapped and like going, I don't know how to do this anymore. It's a fairly universal problem. But I think it's true that many men would say, oh, that's just not true that men are intimidated by strong, powerful women. No, it's not true at all. And yet all I can say is read the book, and time after time after time, I would go on these dates with men that I met here in Pittsburgh. And I mean, who knows why people said, thanks, but no. You know, you never
right.
know.
Right.
But all I could do was look at sort of, you know, there's a point in the book where I'm talking to a friend and I said, why is it so often that it's professional women who are having these troubles? I mean, what does it really mean? And a friend of mine said, well, it's because we made different choices. And I said, I don't remember making anything like a choice. I said, I think I just don't get picked.
Well, and also the choices you're making are things like, what do you want to do for a living? Not mm-hmm. necessarily, okay, if I do this, I'm perhaps going to spend a lot of time by myself.
Right, right. I think it's very difficult for men for professional women to find good partners because our lives are very complicated. We have needs. A lot of people need us, and we can't perform. I mean, culture is changing. The family is changing. And I think it's the generation of men. I'm 40. I think my generation of men grew up with dad worked, mom still kind of worked at the home, or she didn't have the career. And that's kind of what feels right to them, whether they realize it or not. Hmm. The next generation of men, I talked to men who are in their 20s, and they're like, yeah, you know, woman works. No, they don't have as many maybe issues with it, I think, as maybe men who are my age and a little bit older do.
Yeah. If you've just tuned into Prosody, you're listening to Kathy Day read from her memoir, Comeback Season. Kathy, will you read some more?
This is one of my favorite parts of the book, which is where I asked my mother to go through my online matches with me. Mom, come here. I want to show you something. She sits down next to me and I explain how this whole thing works. This is my profile. I'm so proud of you for doing this, my mom says, although I wish you didn't have to. You and me both, Mom. I click on a different button and I explain that every day this company sends me 5 matches. Typically, I sort of like maybe one, sometimes none, but none of the guys I've clicked yes on has ever contacted me back. I tell her it's been really depressing. So I thought maybe you could go through these matches with me so I can get a different perspective. Maybe there's something I'm missing. My mom looks a little nervous. Okay, she says, I'll do the best I can. The first one is Bob, who's included a few extra pictures of himself, including one in which he's wearing bathing trunks. Well, what about him? He's attractive, Mom says. It's true. He has a very nice chest. But it makes me nervous. Don't you think it's odd that a man would include a bare-chested picture of himself? Mom shrugs. Maybe he didn't have any other pictures.
you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Ellen Wadey, and my guest tonight is the writer Kathy Day. That's one of the things that I was thinking that was kind of this underlying parallel between these. In my head, I was thinking you've kind of hotwired these two narratives together that don't typically go together, which is one that's very personal essay from a feminine perspective about what it means to be a woman in the world of a certain age without a partner. Mm-hmm. And then the sports analogy. Mm-hmm. And in bringing those two together, there's this idea of statistics, the statistics of who you are, and that a lot of that determines how people approach you and think about you. And that in the world of sports, it's all about achievement, but often in a personal level, that's not what it's about at all.
Right.
And so then I started thinking about online dating and creating these profiles. And you have to kind of assess yourself in this unusual way.
Yeah. And you do have to. Many people said to me, Kathy, you just need to accept that this is a numbers game. You increase your chances. What you need to do at this point in your life, if you want to meet someone, is you have to increase the possibility of running into someone. You have to, as I put it, you have to put a lot of mojo out there. I called it my try everything strategy, as opposed to the don't try strategy, which I'd been working on for about 7 years, and that hadn't produced anything. So I tried. I literally, for the course of the Colts 2006 season, I literally dedicated myself to trying everything. Like, whatever's out there, I'll try it, you know. And online dating was one of those things. And yes, it is very difficult to have to articulate yourself in this way that you're really uncomfortable with, especially if you're somebody who didn't grow up with MySpace and Facebook. Actually, my biggest piece of advice, and I'll say this right now to anybody who's listening, who's sort of my age and going through this, is don't do online dating first. Go on MySpace or Facebook. Not as somebody looking for love, but maybe as somebody who's like a fan of the Rolling Stones, looking for other fans, or a fan of the Steelers or some other team. And just try to get used to how this works first. That's actually another part that I was going to read about how technology has changed both of these games that we play.
That'd be great. Go ahead.
In both dating and football, technology has changed everything, how the game is played and how we experience the game itself. First, of course, radio and then television allowed us to experience football games without being physically present. Then technology changed how we watched football on TV. The first use of instant replay occurred during a televised football game on December 7, 1963, during the Army-Navy game. The TV announcer felt the need to explain to the potentially confused viewing audience, "This is not live, ladies and gentlemen. Army did not score again." It's hard to imagine watching a televised football game in the low-tech days, before instant replay and sky cams, and when there was no box in the corner of the screen to tell you instantly all the stats, before the crawl that feeds you stats and scores from all the other games that are going on. And I know I'm not the only person who has trouble following live football games now because I keep looking for that magical yellow first down marker. Some of the impediments, like space and time, that once stood between a football fan and the game itself are being obliterated. We can DVR games and watch them later. We can root for teams outside our region. We can connect to our favorite team via DirecTV, online hometown newspapers, internet fan forums. And we can sit on virtual bar stools and virtually cheer and chat with fellow fans before, during, and after games. I don't know if technology is necessarily ruining the game of football or ruining the game of love, but boy, it sure does change how the games are played. Today, dating is played on a postmodern playing field dominated by Generation Y technology and the conventions and social mores that accompany those technologies. Even if you're a boomer who wants to meet another boomer or an Xer seeking a fellow Xer, you still have to get with the program, folks. Of course, it's preferable to meet people through low-tech channels like school, work, organizations you belong to, family, and friends. But when those actual social networks don't produce results, and you've been sitting around your house for a month or a year or a decade, then you'll probably turn, as I eventually did, to virtual social networks. Be prepared, however, for a culture shock. Recently, I did a search on Match.com for younger men from 25 to 32. I admit it, I felt creepy doing this, virtually robbing the cradle. But here were men who were not ashamed to be on Match.com. They smiled broadly and comfortably. Fluent in the communication modes of MySpace and Facebook, these men were able to articulate specifically, in both narrative and list form, who they were, the things they liked, the kind of women they wanted. I practically jumped out of my chair with excitement. For months, I'd been reading these bland profiles written by the modest men of Generation X that told me nothing except that they liked Bill O'Reilly, pizza, and the color blue. Call it Generation Y narcissism, if you like, but their impulse to provide too much information helped me to distinguish what from what. What's really helped me the most, I think, is realizing that an online dating profile isn't a lewd personal ad or a self-promoting billboard. It's helpful to see it as the door to your teenage bedroom or your college dorm room, where you fixed pictures of your cultural icons, your favorite quotes, political slogans, funny cartoons, photographs of yourself doing the things you loved. This door is the gateway between your public self and your private self, a representation of the real you that isn't quite the real you, but also sort of is.
You've been in Pittsburgh how long now?
This is my fourth year.
Okay, so 4 years. So do you find that you have dual allegiances now?
Mm-hmm, I do. It's very hard to follow the Colts here in Pittsburgh because I can't afford DirecTV, and that's the only way I can really follow them. I mean, I went to their first game of the season, but, you know, after a while, you live in a city long enough, you do start to, you know, I was excited about the Penguins almost winning the Stanley Cup last year, and it's kind of hard to not be a part of things. But I think that there's also a part of us that will always root for the teams that, you know, represent who we are. So I think of following a football team as a form of civic pride.
Sure.
You know, and as a kind of nostalgia as well for who we are and what we come from.
Well, and I think, you know, that's part of it. It's all about loyalty and allegiance. Mm-hmm. And if you are a person who feels strongly about loyalty, I remember I'm from Chicago, mm-hmm. so I grew up with the Bears and the Blackhawks and the Bulls. And when I was here in Pittsburgh, I loved the fact of watching the tailgating because it reminded me mm-hmm. exactly of the tailgating that went on at Soldiers Field. And so when I was here, I was perfectly happy being a Pittsburgh fan. Jan the Beatty, mm-hmm. who she and I do the show together, she gave me a Steelers hat. I made the mistake of wearing it in Chicago one day. Somebody looked at me like, "What are you wearing that for?" And I thought, well, you know, we're not playing the Steelers today. Mm-hmm. I can like both teams. But I think that's also kind of a foreign idea for many people, the idea of having really a true connection to a couple different places. Mm-hmm. It's either you're from where you're from or you are not from there because you're trying to just move on to something else. And that's one of the things I really loved about the book as well, is that you're really struggling with that idea of, I just wanted to be from somewhere, you know, and get the heck out of town and go do something else with my life. And then you find out, oh, well, you know, that's ingrained in me more than I thought.
So many people are, because of the economy, we're having to move farther and farther away from where we're from. And I think that in the way that there are Steeler bars and Bears bars and Packer bars all over the country, it's a way that, I mean, in essence, we still, no matter where we go, we still need that sense of home, that sense of place, that sense of tribe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm very lucky. I think that now that I think about it, I rather than becoming a Steelers fan in Pittsburgh, which would have maybe been the best way to maybe meet new people, I did the opposite thing, which was, I'll be a Colts fan in Pittsburgh. That makes a lot of sense. But
that's
I ended up
a lonely choice.
And the funny thing is that I think it was a way to make a wish. I did end up meeting somebody who's from Indiana, who I've known, you know, for a long time. I'd lost touch with. So in a sense, maybe what I was really looking for wasn't necessarily a sports fan, but I was looking for somebody who had that same affinity and that same connection to home, although sure. He's a Bears fan too.
Well, that means he's a good man. Absolutely. Now, did you come back in contact with him because of the book?
Yeah. Actually, I did a radio interview just like this in Indianapolis about a year ago when the book first came out, and he was driving to Kroger's or Marsh and heard me on the radio and got in touch with me. We knew each other in college, and we went to rival colleges. Our colleges play a big football game every year called the Monon Bell Game, and we're actually going to go to the televised Monon Bell Game here in Pittsburgh to watch our alma maters play here in a couple of months.
So. Well, I hope it doesn't bring any, you know, division to your relationship.
Oh, we don't really care about that stuff, honestly. We just thought it would be funny to go to that. So
yeah. One of the other things I'm wondering is when you're writing a piece that's a memoir, at least in writing fiction, it may or may not be true for every writer, but at least my experience of it is you're not really sure with fiction when it ends. Mm-hmm. Did you know what the bracket was for this story?
Well, I kept trying to – even the of course, if you followed that season, the Colts won the Super Bowl, and I did not meet, you know, Mr. Right by the end of the season. And I sort of kept, like, flailing around for a couple months trying to, like, find a happy ending. But then I had to sit down and write the book, and I was like, okay, the point of this seems to be that you the book is done, and you figured out and learned a lot that you never would have learned otherwise, and so you just need to start writing. And I wrote – the end of the book is basically a sort of – our treatise against happy endings and our cultural sort of need for them. And why is it that thinking that I did all these wonderful things and learned so much, met so many new people, and really expanded my circles here in Pittsburgh, why does that mean that I failed? And I had to ask myself that.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, are you sure you're not a Cubs fan? That sounds like a very Cubs philosophy, especially after this past season.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
Well, I have to admit, I'm a White Sox fan, so I'm not sorry. thanks so much for coming. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Ben Cole. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.